Content warning. This podcast contains discussion of child death, violence, and eating disorders. Proceed at your own risk. Imagine for me, if you will, that you stand on a stage. The marble beneath your bare feet is solid, warmed by the sun on what should have been a beautiful day. You are bruised, your body aching after a long and strenuous journey. See now the flies that buzz lazily about, some landing on your arms, others waiting as though they know what is to come. A breeze brushes against you, drying your sweat-soaked skin. At your sides stand two men, their grips firm around your arms, digging into the bruises so tightly that you could swear you were in chains once again. Here before you stand your three sons, the oldest having just reached his 15th birthday, the youngest no older than 10. Each is held tightly, just as you are. The oldest watches you, waiting for a sign as to what to do, while the youngest has begun to cry, the middle looking caught in between. Over the sound of approaching footsteps, the sobs of a young boy trying to keep quiet reach you, and even under that hot summer sun, you cannot turn to look away from your boys. The king comes to stop on the stage. Behind him are three men with spears, and you know what comes next. You have thought to beg, to plead for your life, or even just for the king to allow enough grace for your youngest boy to look away, but the time for begging is over. Under the heavy weight of his jeweled headdress, you can see the sweat on the king's brow, the hatred that seethes in his eyes. When he gives the order, you tense, eyes closing as you wait for the spear. But the cry that comes is not from your own lips, nor the crunch of breaking bones from your own chest. You open your eyes, the sun bright overhead. Where the marble had once been white, you see the sticky crimson that has spilled onto it. The spear sticking from your oldest son's ribs. His eyes stare wide out at you, mouth dripping with blood that has choked his scream. Your second son now recoils in fear, the sobs of your youngest no longer fighting to stay quiet. There's a scream on the boy's lips as they struggle against the hands that hold them. The cry that comes from your lips rattles in your throat, feeling dry against the heat. The second spearman hits your son square in the chest, the rip of his skin audible against the background of a child's screams, and you watch as he falls. His eyes, which looked so much like your own, stare back at you with pain, fear, and perhaps worst of all, betrayal. As the third spearman readies the final blow, you pull hard against the grips that bind you, your feet slipping beneath you. The blood of your firstborn has spilled so far as to reach your feet. It clings to the bare soles of your feet, the smell of iron mixing with the cloyingly sweet smell of death under the hot summer sun. The blood is still warm. The third shock grazes your boy's side, and he screams, the same high-pitched scream of terror made by a child who has spotted a snake or who has unexpectedly fallen. It is not a killing blow, and you watch as the guards drag him over to the execution block that has been so ruefully neglected. He is thrown against it, his scream stopping as the air leaves his chest in a huff. You can feel the fingers digging tighter into your arms as you slip against the blood-slicked marble, but it seems 1,000 miles away. Your boy's eyes are wide and tear-filled, the blood coming from his side leaving his linens red. A guard pulls forth his dagger, drawing it across the boy's throat. Any cry he may have made turns to gurgles as the blood spurts in a fountain from his lips. Finally, the king turns to you. There's another guard with chains, but he sets them aside. Your eyes are on your children, the cries that fall from your throat having grown hoarse from the heat. All three boys lay limp, their eyes still wide, the blood flow having turned from a river to a trickle. Their mouths lay open in never-ending screams, gaping like open wounds, their lips turned red from the blood. The flies that have continued to buzz about lazily have begun to land, covering the boys in a swarming blanket of wriggling black. The final guard approaches you, but you are still struggling, trying to reach her sons as the Yu may be able to breathe the life back into them. He places two meaty hands at the sides of your head, rough palms covering your ears and blocking out the buzzing of the flies, but not the sobs that still rumble in your own throat. His thumbs, massive and calloused, descend upon your eyes, pressing in and turning your vision red. You struggle back now, but the guards hold you firm. The pressure against your eyes grows and grows until it finally pops, blood and ocular fluid weeping down your cheeks in a mockery of the tears you shed only moments before. Your vision turns red, then a deep crimson, before finally becoming darkness. But what lingers in your sight, no matter where you turn your head, no matter how much blood pours out of your useless sockets, is the image of your three boys laying across the stage. This is the final story of Zedekiah, the 20th king of Judah. The Babylonian king that had anointed him seized his city, executed his three sons, before blinding him and imprisoning him for the rest of his life. Though this is not the true wording of how the Bible portrays his story, and indeed it is probably not the most accurate as I have not read the Bible, but it is instead truer to the work of one Johannes Brueggemann, a Franciscan friar of the late 15th century, whose work was explored in a 2014 essay by Hermann Rudenberg. Brueggemann was known for his preaching and was considered to be a seminal orator. Much of his work, and other preachers similar to himself, relied on the usage of visceral sensory words, as well as imagining oneself in the position of the person central to the story, or even a bystander. While it may seem strange to start a podcast about how women navigated religious emotions in medieval times with a story about the 20th king of Judah, I assure you that, should you listen back to this a second time, you may have an entirely different experience indeed. There's one more request I have for you. I would ask you to imagine a young woman named Agnes. She was born to a merchant family in a small city near a monastery that was renowned for its orators. Since the moment she was old enough, she has been attending church every Sunday for sermons and, as she grew older, began attending whenever she could, at least once daily, for prayer. Over time, she has formed a relationship with the preacher there, and he will often read to her from the latest books on Christ and the crucifixion. She is married by age 18 and has her first miscarriage not long after. This, rather than putting her into a depressed state, only increases her religious fervor. Her husband sometimes will not see her for the entire day, which she spends in prayer at the church, and she refuses to lay with him unless he demands it of her. Not long later, she has her first episode. She is at home, sitting in prayer, when she suddenly lets out a scream and falls to the ground, her body racked with convulsions. This lasts a few minutes, in which time her husband has called for the doctor. Once the episode ends, she appears fine, perhaps a little scared, maybe even a little elated, and she states that she has received a vision from God in which she held the baby Jesus and fed him from her own breast. The doctor can find nothing physically wrong with her and, since the episode has ended, leaves the two alone. Over the next several months, she has a few more episodes. Most happen either when she is at home in prayer or attending church. Once she collapsed while attending a sermon. She also found herself collapsed in the middle of the market, with many people staring at her as she came back to herself. After a conversation with her pastor, the episodes no longer scare her, and she begins to develop a reputation as a holy woman. Her episodes come more frequently after that, happening no less than once per week. She swears off sex with her husband, to which he reluctantly agrees, and begins to make pilgrimages across the country. Keep Agnes in mind as we continue to talk about the topic of affective piety. Affective piety is a term used to describe the severe emotional states experienced by women during the medieval period. It was a time of what appeared to be mass hysteria. Women would scream, cry, and even convulse while attending church and going about their daily lives. That was how I initially viewed these events. Perhaps it was comparable to the dancing plague of 1518. Or the more modern Tanganyika laughter epidemic of 1962. However, as evidenced by the previous two examples lasting 3 months and 18 months respectively, events of mass hysteria rarely last years within the same community, much less whole generations. And indeed, there were many women who experienced these events throughout their lives. One such woman was Marjorie Kemp, who was known for her outbursts, referred to by both herself and others as her weepings, so much so that they were considered a sign of the divine by some. She would have mystical experiences of watching the crucifixion and breastfeeding an infant Jesus, all of it feeling real and tangible. During her weepings, she would scream and cry out, often finding herself unable to move, and sometimes even collapsing as she was so overcome with emotion that she could no longer hold herself upright. Regardless of where she was, in her home, at church, in the market, she would find herself collapsed and in an utter wreck of emotion. Perhaps then, these outbursts were ways to release pent-up emotion. Women at the time were not privy to the same rights as they are now, and society as a whole was subject to plagues, famines, and natural disasters without the aid of modern technology. So it's not a stretch to say that there would have been a buildup of emotions with few outlets to release them. While this theory may have played a part, it's certainly true that emotions would have run high with nowhere to go, much as they do today in the face of disaster and horror. I do not believe it is the full extent of the truth. To understand effective piety, we must first understand emotion, something that is easier said than done. The study of emotion is fraught with battles that have been ongoing for decades, and psychology as a discipline has yet to reach consensus on just what emotion is. The first problem comes with defining emotion. What counts? Sadness is surely an emotion, but what of exhaustion? And why is it that emotional words and categories vary across cultures and time? Certain psychologists, such as Paul Ekman, propose that there are basic emotions that other emotions are built upon. You can think of it like building blocks. Each block is a basic emotion, and to create more complex emotions, these blocks must be stacked together. Or you can think of it like the Pixar movie Inside Out, in which the emotions of a child's brain are all distinct and separate from each other, but can combine to create more complex emotions. This theory would follow that the basic emotions are naturally built into the human brain and that these emotions do not vary. The words across cultures might be different, but the emotions they describe are the same. Though this theory holds some water, the seven basic emotions are recognized almost universally across cultures. This theory is a little ethnocentric. The emotions Ekman defines as the core seven are based on English emotional words, and are derived entirely from expressions rather than feeling, specifically the expressions of Americans. This not only neglects how emotion can vary across context and culture in ways that his theory cannot fully explain, but it also ignores how emotion has changed over time. As Barbara Rosenwine has explored in her 2016 book, Generations of Feeling, A History of Emotions, what is considered to be an emotion has changed over time. For example, exhaustion, which is widely considered by modern psychology to not qualify as emotion, but is rather a physiological state, has been considered an emotion in many historical cultures, such as ancient Greece. Psychology as a discipline has a habit of viewing any historical evidence that doesn't line up with modern conceptions as wrong. But how can something so subjective as emotions ever be wrong? Lisa Feldman Barrett, a seminal researcher in the field of emotional psychology, states that Ekman's theory is wrong, and that her decades of research prove it. The theory she proposes in her 2017 paper answers the question of how emotions happen. Do emotions cause the physical reactions, or do physical reactions cause the emotion? Feldman Barrett would say that the physical reaction comes first, and emotions are a cognitive adaptation meant to aid survival. Perhaps the easiest way to explain this is through an example. We all know the feeling of getting butterflies in your stomach. It's a sign that your body is switching out of rest and digest mode into something that will leave you with more energy. However, this physical reaction can have different meanings depending on the context. If you are on a date with a very attractive person and it's going well, those butterflies might be excitement. However, if you're walking down the street late at night and realize that someone has been following you for the last three blocks, it becomes something much more sinister. It's the same physical reaction, and yet it carries distinct meanings that rely on the context of a situation. In this way, we can also induce emotions. By triggering certain reactions in specific contexts, we can activate certain emotional pathways in our brains that are associated with specific emotions. The brain is very good at associating locations with emotions. It's the reason why your heart might start racing when you drive past the dentist office. Because emotions are so based in context, that means there is considerable variation across cultures, and even across people within the same culture. There is evidence that different cultures respond to physical stimuli differently, and therefore prepare different emotions even when exposed to the same stimuli. For example, as Feldman-Barrett explains in her 2017 TED Talk, in some cultures, such as our own, the reaction to defeat is to cry, so as to express remorse, whereas other cultures might show stoic acceptance. This can lead to cultural miscommunication, but also shows the nature of just how variable emotions are. It's also true that two people from the same culture will not have the same reaction to the same stimuli, though their reactions may be similar. Something might bring joy to two people, but the level of joy might be different. With this in mind, how can we interpret effective piety? Well, let's bring back our good friend Agnes. Every week, and sometimes every day, she went to the same church to listen to the same pastor give sermons. This pastor, like Brugman, spoke with passion, often inviting her to imagine herself in violent and traumatic situations, using vivid sensory imagery to make the scenario feel more real. She attended those sermons at the same time every day, sat in the same pew every day, and heard the same voice every day, all while her body was being induced into a state of fear, pain, and trauma. It wouldn't take long for her body to start associating those feelings with the church, meaning that every time she passed the church, her heart would start to race as her body prepared to either fight or flee. Not only would this reaction apply to the physical church, but it would also apply to the words being spoken as well. In the same way that people with arachnophobia may experience a fear reaction when the word spider is said, the physical reactions to the words the pastor was speaking may have become linked to the content of his sermons. Most often, those were words on Jesus and Mary. Thus, when she heard others speak of these topics, even in passing, the same reaction may start once again. Or, even just thinking about Christ, a topic that would have been difficult to avoid thinking about in the medieval period, could have also triggered these reactions. When compared to the modern examples I've used, phobias, defeat, joy, the reactions experienced with moments of effective piety may seem extreme. In most people, moments of joy, even in the extreme, do not cause you to fall from your chair, or to experience convulsions, or even to scream and cry uncontrollably. Perhaps that is because the examples I've used are ones which are more accessible to the average person. We must consider that these sermons asked the listener to imagine themselves in the position of Christ, to feel their hands being nailed to the cross, to experience the pain of being tortured, and did so vividly. Even though it was just imagination, repeated exposure to these lifelike scenarios, which were comparable to mystic visions, or even said to be so real that there was a separation from reality, could traumatize the person experiencing them. We know that in the modern day, as explored by DeRoma and colleagues in their 2003 paper, media exposure to traumatic events, such as 9/11, can increase symptoms of PTSD for a short time. It is possible that with repeated exposure to triggering material, symptoms of PTSD, such as vivid flashbacks, hypervigilance, and increased anxiety, could occur. Now, don't misunderstand, I'm not saying that effective piety was synonymous with PTSD, nor am I saying that it was a result of PTSD. On the contrary, women who experienced effective piety often described a type of euphoria that came with the visions. The pain they experienced was not terrifying, but divine, a deeper connection to God, or even a blessing to experience that which Christ himself felt. However, I do believe that these experiences had some root in traumatization. Though these experiences may have involved some elation, women such as Marjorie Kemp describe having a transitional period where they are frequently tempted by the devil. It is also worth noting that Marjorie Kemp described her weepings as starting after a series of repeated traumas: difficult pregnancies, her children dying, and an attempted affair, which may have left her more vulnerable to experiencing the vivid visions induced through the church. It is possible, too, that her pastor was not the same type of orator as Brugman. Perhaps, through her own suffering, Marjorie started to imagine herself in the same positions as the person she had been hearing about since birth. When she struggled with her pregnancy, she may have imagined herself as the Virgin Mary, the ideal mother figure with a child that survived birth. It is also possible that, considering women were so ostracized by the church, this may not have only been a method for processing grief and trauma, but also a way to integrate herself into the religion that was so important to medieval life. We can see similar scenarios extended into the modern day as well. In Portugal, an emphasis on body purity through the restriction of food has resulted in what Carolyn Walker Bynum refers to as holy anorexia in her 1988 paper. Food has always been a fixation for the Catholics, what with the consumption of the Eucharist. In this context, however, the readings of certain texts has led to the belief that not eating rejects hunger and, in a way, rejects womanhood by abstaining from personhood, since being a person requires eating food. Rejection of food to eat only the Eucharist is something that has been well documented in Christianity, one famous example being Catherine of Siena. This pious fervor, while perhaps not as extreme as convulsions and screaming, can result in feelings of elation and closeness to the divine, as well as creating visions similar to those that were previously mentioned. With Catholicism creating such a strong link between divinity and food, it is no wonder that some may turn away from it entirely in an attempt to embrace purity, just as women like Marjorie Kemp embraced the pain and trauma that was preached to them in an attempt to become closer to the divine. Perhaps a more familiar modern example of effective piety can be found in the Pentecostal church. Indeed, there are many connections between women like Marjorie Kemp and the modern Pentecostal church, something Nicole Klan explores in her 2010 review. The Pentecostals link their bodies with spirituality, as opposed to believing that spirituality creates a disconnect between the physical form and the mind. Their worship is not quiet. In fact, it is considered common in sermons for people to cry out, to speak in tongues, or to collapse completely. For them, the spiritual is sensory. These experiences are not signs of weakness, as they may be for others, but instead a show of dependence on God, for He controls their physical reactions when they cannot, just as Marjorie thought that only God could control her weepings. This emphasis on the body as a vessel and the sensation it experiences is similar to the graphic and explicit depictions of violence that was preached by the orators of medieval times, and may play some role in the bizarre expressions of faith that can be found within the Pentecostal church. To conclude, there are many factors at play in the phenomena of effective piety, most of which do not include experiences such as hallucinations or mass hysteria. Attempts by the church to create passion within their flock may have led to traumatization and the cognitive link between the church and divine pain. This, in turn, may have led to the extreme emotional states and extreme physical reactions that are associated with effective piety. The religious fervor that is related to sensory and bodily experiences has not disappeared in the centuries since the time of Marjorie Kemp, but have instead transformed into new versions, perpetrated by the same focus on bodily purity, pain, and devotion. However, it was not entirely a negative thing. I end now by telling you that Agnes went on to make many pilgrimages across Europe and became renowned in her community as a holy woman. She influenced the paths of future pilgrimages and was even involved in the creation of a shrine along one of the paths. Though Agnes was fictional, her life is a reflection of women like Marjorie Kemp, who influenced not only the progression of Christianity, but ideas surrounding emotion, sensation, and the body as well. Thank you for listening.